conversation we've been able to have with them around all of these different recommendations. And in this case, you know, the Police Bureau has, we have come a long way since 2010 in our response and our philosophy in being able to rapidly approach somebody who's we've used deadly force on and be able to get them treatment. And one of the many tools that we have that we believe in is the ability also to use a canine to be able to do that. In this particular incident, the decision was made to use the canine to move him away from the weapon. He had a weapon, and you heard Julie Ruin talk about, here's a balance between a gun and a knife. A gun close by is a bigger threat to approaching officers. So the use of the dog was to move him away from that weapon, further away from that weapon.
The ballistic shield, if he had have been capable of grabbing the weapon and it had it been a gun, the ballistic shield, that's the purpose of the ballistic shield, right?
That it is to provide you some more protection. It does not cover all of you or all of the team that is approaching. It is just something that hopefully might save your life if you come under fire. It doesn't protect you completely. It's not a shield that protects the team of people coming up. It just, that very first person that is being approached, it partially helps cover them.
Is the protocol that one person approaches to check on the subject and potentially?
No, we train to go up as a team. So because one person is holding that shield, other people need to be able to cover that threat.
So why was that not done in this case and it was done in all the other cases?
Again, this is one of several tools we use. This one in particular, they made the decision at the time to separate this person further from the weapon. When a weapon is close by to you, it's pretty easy for somebody to pick that up and start shooting at you. And you can't rely on, all right, this shield is just going to protect us all, because it won't. It just increases your chances of survival.
So I would appreciate it if an amended response, because the recommendation would that you should evaluate whether it's appropriate to use a canine. I think what I'm hearing you say is that, yes, you are evaluating the cases of when it's appropriate. And I would be interested to know as to what the policy is to when you do and when you don't.
Yeah, well, what we can do is provide you with what we train our members. So you can see here's that assessment, those officers and supervisors on scene. That assessment's pretty in-depth. Where's the weapon? What kind of weapon it is? We've got the ability to is the weapon separated enough? We're comfortable just going up there rapidly. Can we approach on the side of a car? Can we use the shield? Do we need to use less lethal? Is a canine appropriate? Or at the far end of things, worst case, it's a delayed cert call out. So we really, in our training, we think that is a good tool in our tool bag to have.
Can the canine pick up the weapon and take it away? Can it be trained to do that?
No.
I don't believe so.
Thank you.
Chief, that exchange was very helpful for me because I think I have a better understanding now. So can I just walk you through a few things just to make sure we have a baseline? So the first is the 48-hour rule, as it's written, does not apply to every investigation, correct?
The 48-hour rule only applies to internal investigations.
Right. And it says whenever delay in conducting the interview will not jeopardize the successful accomplishment of the investigation or when criminal culpability is not an issue, blah, blah, blah. So that's a qualification. So right. By definition, doesn't apply to everything.
Correct.
Okay. If you were to successfully negotiate the removal of the so-called 48-hour rule, what you've done now is accelerated the process of having to tackle a couple of complicated questions. Because under the 48-hour rule, there's potentially a 48-hour delay until you have to tackle these questions. Now you're at the scene, you're gathering information, you potentially can do some things sooner. And so let me make sure I understand what you view as the competing concerns. From the public's point of view, there's the view that, and I think from the consultants, that interviewing someone as soon as possible ensures fresh, timely information and is helpful if for no other reason than over time people's memory begins to fade and maybe reconstruct events in their head. And also, the information you get early can lead to other investigatory techniques. So things you learn within the 48 hours can help you chase other leads and do things. So I'm seeing a nod in the back. So I seem to recall that from an earlier presentation, that both the freshness of the information and the ability to use the information to do a more thorough investigation, the earlier in the process is better. So that's one issue. The second issue that is outlined in the memo that you and the mayor have put in is that there's a complicated constitutional set of questions. And if we compel someone to say something that ends up infringing on a Fifth Amendment right, and there is some kind of criminal investigation, we are potentially compromising that investigation.
Yes, sir.
Commissioner Fritz, I think, has astutely noted that this is the rare instance that there is an officer and followed by a bona fide criminal investigation. The problem with that is, and I'll just use a real-world example, when someone knocks on my door and says, "Hi, we're the police, we want to talk to you," I don't actually have to sort of sit there calculating whether it's likely to result in my being arrested and prosecuted or not. I have a right to say, "I don't want to talk to you." And we don't have to roll the roulette. We don't have to sort of roll the dice to figure out whether we think it may or may not. A lawyer can come in and close the door. And in the healthcare setting, since I used to represent the hospital workers of the greater New York area, the minute there's even a hint of some kind of criminal prosecution, a lawyer shows up and says, we're not having any further conversations because there's a Fifth Amendment right. There might be discipline that follows for that, but the Fifth Amendment right is inviolate because that is when someone is facing losing their liberty. And under our system, even someone who is ultimately going to be charged and convicted can't be forced to waive a Fifth Amendment right.
Correct.
So it's complicated. And I guess what I still don't fully understand is the question that Commissioner Fritz asked, which is, if we do away with the 48-hour rule and we're saying that we want you to have this option of getting more information earlier in the process, how do you balance these two things? And as she said, we're not the only city in America. So I would join with my colleague in just being interested, how do other cities slice it? And I'm guessing our consultants have some thoughts, but we're not making this up anew. There's a lot of history in other jurisdictions about how to slice it and how to narrow the risk that a compelled statement ultimately frustrates a prosecution. I see another nod in the back, so hopefully I'm on the right track. And that's what Amanda was getting at, and I agree. I'd like to know how you do slice that.
Because she had mentioned a couple particular local departments, but one of the things that we know nationwide, there are many large departments that build their process around never getting an interview from the officer. And there's challenges to that. You know, we have gotten to the point, like George was talking about, we get information out as quick as we can to be transparent, anything that won't compromise the investigation. Some of these other processes that are built around not getting information from an officer, investigations take a long time, may not ever get to a grand jury. So there's, the crux of that challenge is going to be and the district attorney is part of that conversation because it really is their investigation and the potential for compromising that a potential criminal prosecution.
And let me be clear, I applaud you for negotiating the 48-hour rule out of the PPCOA contract, and I think we have to develop a strategy in the contracts to follow. I think I understand why now more clearly it's in the public interest to have that earlier opportunity to get the information. What I don't want to do, though, is set expectations about what's going to happen as a result and then have people frustrated that it doesn't lead to the kinds of increased transparency and accountability, which is the whole underlying point of this exercise. So I want to be absolutely clear about expectations. So thank you.
Okay. Other questions for the chief, for his staff? Anything else that you want to add?
No, sir. Thank you very much for the opportunity to respond.
Should we bring Michael and Julie back up? Because it looked like they did have some thoughts on that question, and then we'll take testimony after that. Welcome your reactions and thoughts to that. We don't have to play point counterpoint here, but this is
understood.
Important discussion.
We will try to not make this a law school tutorial. Um, the doctrine that the dialogue between you all and the Bureau had is accurate on its face. I would, and I do understand the concern about what might happen or could happen potentially legally, potentially, if in fact a compelled statement is obtained from an officer. It is absolutely true that if in fact a compelled statement is obtained from an officer, that that statement could not be used for purposes of any criminal prosecution. That is the law. However, the concern about the risk that somehow the obtaining of that compelled statement could then jeopardize a criminal investigation in this context has never happened in the history of mankind with regard to officer-involved shootings. Now, the North case that Commissioner Fish brought up is an important case because it is one of the few times in which compelling an individual did result in eventually undoing a subsequent prosecution. But North was really a case that stood on its own for a whole lot of reasons. And one of the biggest reasons, and the distinction I make between North and the officer-involved shooting context, is that in North, when that compelled statement was taken, it was taken in front of everybody. Cameras were rolling. It wasn't taken in the secrecy of an interview room, unlike officer-involved shooting compelled statements. You know, officer-involved shooting compelled statements are taken in an interview room. They are, in jurisdictions that do this, and there are a number of jurisdictions that do this, that information is then walled off and protected from any piece of the detective investigation, so that when the detective investigation goes to the district attorney, that statement will never be presented to them. And therefore, there's no risk of contaminating the district attorney's investigation with that compelled statement.
The more I listen to you, the more sorry I am that we don't have the district attorney here to opine, because you made a very compelling statement. Are there gradations within what we're talking about? If there's no 48-hour rule and we're trying to balance all these concerns, are there certain kinds of investigations where based on your survey of other departments, it's prudent to delay a little bit to ensure that we don't get it wrong? Or are you confident saying that in almost every instance, the benefits of an early intervention, a statement, and the investigation outweighs the risk?
I'm confident that in the officer-involved shooting context, if the protocols are complied with and if there's no leakage of information to the district attorney or the detectives that are conducting the criminal investigation, if you do create robust processes to prevent that from happening, that you're not going to risk any eventual criminal prosecution. In fact, the criminal prosecution can go forward on its own. And in fact, in this city, in this county, by and large, eventually officers almost always, there have been a couple exceptions in the cases we've looked at, but almost always voluntarily provide a statement to the grand jury anyway. So the district attorney, in evaluating whether or not to file criminal charges, has almost always had a voluntary statement from bureau officers.
Last question, because it feels a little abstract the way we're discussing this. Can you give us just a concrete example of something that you might learn within the 48 hours from an officer on the scene that then enhances the quality of the investigation?
Absolutely. What it does is it provides you with an insight into the officer's state of mind right after he has used deadly force. And if you don't get that information that night, you run the risk of, by the time you get that information being influenced, contaminated by a whole host of other external influences. If there's a videotape of the incident, the officer may have an opportunity or may inadvertently see it. If there is discussion about the incident in the locker room when the officer goes to work the next day, that information may contaminate the person. The legal advisor to the officer will often have information that he or she is free to provide that officer during discussions prior to the obtaining of the statement. So there's a whole host of information that could impact what eventually the officer provides. And we've seen it throughout the country, you know, in South Carolina. What if instead of, and this is a case in which the murder charge was filed, what if instead of getting a statement from the officer that night, they had said, go home for a couple days and provide a statement? The statement that they got would have been well different once that officer had an opportunity to see the cell phone video of what had transpired and captured the event. That's the kind of, you know, dynamic that we would miss, or we are missing, I think, potentially, every time you wait for more than 2 days to get a statement.
That's helpful. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Okay, let's see if we have public testimony, please.
We have five testifiers. Will Dan Handelman, Debbie Iona, Sarah Hobbs, please come up?
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor. While we're setting up here, would it be okay if I have 5 minutes to testify today?
Certainly.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Okay, I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch, and Portland Cop Watch believes that many of the recommendations in the new OIR group report can make a better police bureau. OIR does a very good job warning the bureau against using the term suicide by cop, which presupposes the outcome of a confrontation with a person intent on provoking the police to shoot them is for the police to accommodate that desire. But we once again are disappointed in the consultants for not focusing on issues of race. Specifically, 4 of the 11 cases involve people of color. We suggest the Bureau might think about adding a standard question in all shooting reviews. Did the suspect's race play a role in your decision to use deadly force? Not written in our 8-page analysis is our concern that OIR expresses support for the PPB's transparency. Police review board hearings and behavioral health unit advisory committee meetings, for example, are not open to the public. The chief's initial reply to the 31 recommendations, and we only just saw his full reply this morning or this afternoon, reflect a general lack of response to the community and the COAB about suggestions received on bureau policies. OIR says that other cities have less information from their police, and we feel sorry for those other cities. We do appreciate that OIR included good information, such as calling for the city to remove the 48-hour rule, and I can talk more about that, but there's not enough time, from the contract. What also needs to come out of that contract is the stuff prohibiting civilian investigation of deadly force and the binding arbitration clause for deadly force incidents. Telling the city not to sacrifice thoroughness for the sake of timeliness, that suggestion should apply to all misconduct complaints and appeals. They included cumulative totals of African Americans and Latinos subjected to deadly force in the 35 cases they reviewed since 2010. It's 10 and 3, respectively, making 29% and 9% of all the victims. Adding a table of the 35 incidents showing data about cases involving mental health issues, which comes out to 57% of the suspects, and unarmed suspect, which was 26%. Despite the overall lack of analysis of race, they told the Bureau to take corrective action when officers say things such as, quote, shuck and jive, to describe African-American suspects' behavior, which happened in one of the cases. We also noted a number of issues OIR highlighted or failed to note in individual cases. In summary, a commander wrote that Sergeant Fort's ill-advised shooting at Kevin Moffitt was done in the, quote, fog of war. A sergeant allowed 2 officers who shot at Joshua Baker to remain in the field because they were in, quote, combat mode. Nobody compared Officer Gregory Moore shooting at the back of African-American teenager Juwan Blackman to the Aaron Campbell incident, though OIR did point out there was no review of the canine, which bit the wrong person when released in that case. Neither Officer Jason Lyle nor Larry Wingfield was disciplined, even though they put themselves into a position that precipitated their shooting and killing homeless veteran Thomas Higginbotham. And furthermore, Lyle violated training by holding a taser and gun at the same time. Sergeant John Holbrook and Officer David Scott also precipitated the death of Brad Morgan by getting too close to him, but were not disciplined. OIR says the city can protect itself better in lawsuits by examining repeat shooter officers like Sergeant Nathan Voller, who shot David Hughes in 2006 and Merle Hatch in 2013. Even though their table implies numerous officers were disciplined for using force, the only one for whom the discipline stuck was Officer Dane Wiester, who was fired for permanently injuring William Monroe. The Police Review Board removed a commander's recommended debriefing for Officer Justin Clary, who shot at Billy Wayne Sims in front of a populated convenience store in 2012. We also note that the auditor announced the report was done under city code, and she corrected herself this morning, that authorized the IPR to hire experts, but it is actually required that these are annual reports, and they have not come out every year. You heard there's only been 9 of them in 15 years. Since OIR is now at the end of its contract, the shootings from 2014 and 2015 should be under review already. The most recent case in this report is nearly 3 years old. We would also welcome if OIR could recommend such important issues, such as IPR should conduct its own investigations into deadly force cases. The DA should hold grand juries even when the suspect is not killed by police, which doesn't always happen. And to allow civilians to appeal the outcomes of deadly force cases to the Citizen Review Committee. And those appeals might have changed some of the poor outcomes that OIR noted in its report. Thank you. And I guess since I have 30 more seconds, I will say about the 48-hour rule and the compelling testimony, I think that Commissioner Fritz is quite right. I mean, when Chief O'Day said the most recent incident was Officer Wiester, that's the only time they've ever indicted an officer for on-duty use of force in the history of Multnomah County. It's not, you know, the community's been saying for many years, if you compel the officer to testify and we can't prosecute him, if we lose one officer's ability to put them in jail and we can fire them, that's okay for now. We can look at it again after that happens. But, you know, let's get rid of an officer if they shot somebody in violation of the law and in violation of the policies.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Debbie, would you like to be next?
Sure. I'm Debbie Iona, representing the League of Women Voters of Portland. The periodic reports on police shootings and deaths in custody are an important element in Portland's efforts to improve police bureau operations. They not only provide guidance to the bureau, but also inform the community about the details of specific cases, what went well, and where there is room for improvement. After careful review of the report and participation in yesterday's community meeting with the OIR group, the League would like to offer the following comments. In the future, allow more time for the public and city officials to review the report. 1 week is not sufficient to digest a report of this length and complexity and provide feedback. Training division reviews of specific incidents and officer training are discussed throughout the report. We strongly recommend that the Bureau's Training Advisory Council receive a briefing on this report. There is much in it for the TAC to consider and address. When drafting the next contract for the expert review of closed investigations, include a review of all the recommendations made to date by PARC and OIR, whether they are being implemented, and to what extent. If the Bureau chose not to implement the expert's recommendation, it should provide an explanation. The auditor mentioned that the people involved in shootings cannot appeal their cases to the CRC, Citizen Review Committee. In our view, shootings are just part of a larger continuum of interactions between the police and the public, and we see no reason why people involved in shootings or their families cannot appeal their cases to the CRC. The report describes areas in which the Bureau has improved its operations and others where more training, better execution, and greater accountability are needed. The discussion of cases in which the subject had in one way or another expressed a desire to provoke a lethal response from the police was particularly compelling. We hope the Bureau will train its officers to avoid looking upon the outcome in those cases as inevitable, and use their training and tactical advantage to resolve the incident without resorting to deadly force. Furthermore, we have heard over and over again from the outside experts reviewing closed cases of shootings that the 48-hour delay in interviewing involved officers is bad policy. The League encourages the city to change this provision in the union contract. We would like to thank Auditor Caballero's office and the OIR group for this valuable report. It's a really great resource, I know, for the Bureau, but also for the members of the public who are involved in these issues. Thanks.
My name's Sarah Hobbs, and I've come to really push for support of recommendation number 25. People who are suicidal are at an extreme mental health crisis, and they're not thinking rationally. But because of prior, what's the word I'm thinking here, history, where when I talk to people about rulings that are ruled suicide by cop, it's, Sarah, they pointed a gun at the police. What do you think was going to happen? Because the mentality seems to be when they provoke because they're suicidal but cannot carry through on their own, oh, yeah, we force an issue with the police will do the ultimate act for us. And that is an issue with me because that goes to address a long history of response in these issues. What I hope, and one of the things with language, culture, and mentality, that the police department comes to realize they're dealing with people who are not thinking rationally, and it's really going to fall on them to be the one making the rational decisions and to look at how, when these situations are happening, they work to negotiate in a way that does not, I say, give to the person what they're desiring. For the record, I do see where on the issue of crisis suicide calls, the police bureau has been putting into place a lot of the recommendations in this report. But it's still a lot of room for improvement. So I do ask that you really look at recommendation 25. And really, that's all I came to say.
I have a question about that, and that how long has the term suicide by cop been something that has been common parlance?
I have lived now in Portland for 26 years, and it's been used ever since I lived here. Before then, I cannot address because I was not living in the state.
So for 20 years?
For the 26 years that I've lived here, yes, I'm aware of. Yes, ma'am.
I really appreciate this being called out and then you reemphasizing it. I think in some ways it's been helpful to remind people that there are people experiencing mental illnesses who are the subject of tragedies involving the police. And I think it's a tragedy for the police officer as well as for the family and the person who's no longer with us. It's one of those terms, I think, that's now outlived its usefulness and that we all need to be rethinking, reframing, and helping the wider community to understand why that's no longer a helpful phrase.
What concerns me is when a person who is in an extreme suicidal crisis who cannot commit the act on their own, they automatically think, oh, I pull a knife, I pull a gun, point it at the cops, they're going to do it for me because the mentality based on history leads them to believe that. And that, for me, it's a big concern.
We need to think of something like involuntary commitment by cop or some other term that better reflects that. There's many times, and this is the sad part. I appreciate this report and the responses. There are many incidents where our officers stop people from harming themselves and stop other incidents. I think the mayor mentioned there are about four suicides prevented in one day just
December
recently.
4th, yes.
Yeah, so that's also part of the community discussion that we need to have as to how our officers, some of whom came into the police 30 years ago and mental health care was not part of the job expectation that they signed up for, with the collapse of the mental health system, even though it wasn't all that great in the first place, it's a different job now. And that many of them are embracing that it's being the guardian of community peace and helping people out as well as defending against bad stuff.
I have said all along since I've been working to have the issue of suicide by cop addressed. Portland police have made a lot of positive progress. There's still a need, though, to continue pushing the positive forward when it comes to the issue of what a role by suicide by cop.
Thank you for your partnership.
And Commissioner Fritz, I need to add that even though it's not part of the purview of OIR or the City Council per se, it doesn't help when the medical examiner declares Mr. Johnson's death last November to be a suicide when the police actually shot him to death. So I'm hoping that's something the council will take this recommendation and move it forward to the state police and the medical examiner's office.
That's an interesting thought of how would it be described in a more helpful way. Thank you.
Dan, I have a question for you, if I could. You note that we are required to have annual reports, and then you note that this is the last of the OIR group reports. And you say shootings from 2014 and 2015 should already be under review. So do you have a recommendation?
Well, I'm hoping the auditor is going to answer that question. I don't know if the new contract has gone out. We didn't even know when this contract got extended. It was supposed to end a year ago. But I think that, you know, OIR has been doing a good job. There's other groups that are out there, and, you know, we'll see where things go. Whatever happens, whoever takes the contract up has to take a continuity perspective, like Debbie was saying, that we need to look at all the recommendations that have already been made and make sure they keep getting moved forward with any new ones that come in.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
And we have three more. Nancy Newell, Barbara Russ, and Jared Hegger.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you. Thank you for all your great consideration and work. I'm here today because I'm working with COAP.
Oh, put your name in the record, Nancy.
Pardon me?
Put your name in the record.
Oh, yes, Nancy Newell.
Thank you.
And I represent, we've formed a Wilshire Park group because we've had murders in our community that have basically been put under, you know, it just kind of loses the story. And the history of me living in that neighborhood for that many years, when there's a drug raid and they get the wrong house, there's certain things that take place where there are weapons in our community that I asked an officer, why are you here and what's the purpose? And I didn't get any kind of response. I mainly got shoved away. So I just stand as witness, but they had the wrong house. So there's certain things that have happened in my life experience living in Portland related to the police. And I've done my best as hopefully a de-escalator to switch some of those situations. And I think we really need more training within the police force. How much trauma for the entire community when these horrible incidents happen, when someone opens fire on people, and the police really can't do anything about it because it happens so fast, there's no way of predicting it. And how much trauma does it have on their own practices within the community, especially having to deal with the mentally ill? As you pointed out, Commissioner Fritz, the problem has gone to the streets because we don't have the funds to take care of our own. So we're handed quite a heavy responsibility to address issues that complicate each day because the problems aren't going away. The numbers of mentally ill, the stresses, and a recent case of racial issue. How come tasers are not regarded as a weapon of force? I mean, it was a young man whose heart rate was so high, they were hoping he would survive. They rushed him to the hospital. And he faced 20 years as a 16-year-old of jail for just walking home from school. Luckily, there was a camera that caught the whole thing. So what within the process protects young people when they're just going about their daily lives and a situation happens and they don't have any other proof? And how carefully is that observed within the practices of the community? And how can we help police through trauma heal from trauma? I think there has to be a lot more healing applied to both citizens as well as police, and not just training, because the human nervous system, without realizing, is conditioned to trigger response since we have so many triggers in our society.
You know, with this conversation reminds me, little Nancy, is I was teacher for a day or principal for a day at an elementary school in Outer East where there's tremendous turnover in the student body, partly because it's in an area where there's unstable housing. And so people are moving a lot. And kids, 50% of the third grade class didn't complete the year because of moving. The single common thread in terms of the concern that the principal had about learning was that kids were coming to school traumatized.
Mm-hmm.
Traumatized because they were in areas where they were witnessing violence,
mm-hmm.
or they had unstable families,
mm-hmm.
or they were moving.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one thing we know about children is if you're not coming to school ready to learn, you can't learn.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we undo that so that there isn't the trauma just in the learning experience? And it's a related subject to what you're identifying.
Yeah, one thing I experienced too, I don't have a whole lot of time left. I'll try to fit it in quick. But the testimony that I witnessed during court on that particular case of this young African-American student, the officer I was observing, the sergeant who was in charge of the other officer that kicked him so hard on his spleen, the sergeant said, I would never do that. I know I could explode his spleen and possibly kill him. So why didn't the sergeant stop his officer? And he didn't even suggest that in court. And also he used the taser, and then the taser expert said various things about using a taser. You have to limit how you use it, and he's shaking his head in the court audience. So how do we address that and be able to find that within officers' way of performing their jobs? That's a big thing to consider.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi. My name is Barbara Ross, and I'm here testifying as an individual, not as a part of any organization. I want to highlight a couple of things that Julie brought out in her testimony. I understand that you can't control everything, and so I want to just emphasize a couple of things that you as a police commissioner and the management can, in fact, have an impact on. There are just two things that I want to talk about. One is giving a high priority to officer safety by keeping a reasonable distance between themselves and potentially dangerous subjects. In the Hatch case, they acted wisely, and the officers and the sergeants who responded to the call, and this is quoting from the report, and the officers and the sergeants who responded to the call involving Mr. Hatch all recognized the appropriate goal was to contain and isolate Mr. Hatch with the hopes of stabilizing the situation. On the contrary, in the Higginbotham case, officers did not concentrate on their own safety and, quote, neither recognized how to make a more informed decision about whether or how to approach the likely armed, violent man in the confined space. They might not have allowed the officers to avoid being in the position where they were forced to use deadly force. In addition, an additional discussion in this case, they said, quote, as we have stated before, tactical decision-making that is consistent with the principles of officer safety provides smart techniques for detention and apprehension that provide the police the ability to more frequently influence how the encounter will end, particularly here when Mr. Higginbotham was found holed up in a room, not going anywhere, and did not present a threat to anyone else. Time and resources were on the side of the officers. So I would urge that continued attention be given to recommendation one, which emphasize the Bureau's opportunity to influence the outcome of encounters with dangerous individuals. The other area where Bureau management can influence the outcome is making sure that the sergeant in command, looking at the whole situation, and delegates others to carry out tactical assignments. In four of the shootings, on-scene sergeants assigned themselves to tactical roles despite the presence of officers to whom they could have delegated these tasks. So since the training was that the sergeant should not be involved in tactical activity and should remain in control, that's something that's been overlooked in the reviews by the training review and by the commanders in control. So I think it's important that we continue as management of the Bureau to emphasize those two recommendations. And so I appreciate your attention. I appreciate the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Jared Hager. I'm an assistant United States attorney with the Department of Justice. We're currently involved in overseeing a settlement agreement with the City of Portland and the Portland Police Bureau. I just wanted to make a few comments on the issue of compelled statements, given the questions from the commissioners and Mr. Mayor, I appreciate the time. You know, as an overarching issue, I do want to commend the city and the Portland Police Bureau. We've seen incredible seriousness that they've taken with these issues, and I've seen incredible progress with respect to, you know, just to name one, the Behavioral Health Unit, and taking these issues seriously. To the point of compelled statements and the risk of immunity, we are in conversations with the district attorney and the city of Portland to try to come to a resolution and understanding of those issues. As you mentioned, Commissioner Fish, they are incredibly complicated, and there are various academic issues at stake or at play where it's, there isn't necessarily clear guidance. That being said, the Department of Justice has given advice and guidance to other cities in respect of other settlement agreements with police use of force issues. Our understanding is that certain reports are not considered compelled, and so I'd like to just add two issues for you to consider. First, on the issue of whether something's compelled, the case law, as we understand it, says something's compelled only when you face the threat of a job loss, not necessarily just discipline. So there's a question of whether, you know, at what point are you actually compelling a response. A second, and what I think more important exception to the risk of immunity is for routine reports. There are cases from all over the country, federal courts, where they have held that routine reporting that is part of a public employee's job duty, for example, a use of force report or a police report at the end of your shift, is not something that's subject to immunity. We're going to continue our discussions with the city and the district attorney, but I just wanted to bring those two issues, whether or not something's compelled and whether or not a routine report is subject to immunity, to the council's attention.
It's amazing to have you here testifying. Almost feels like a Woody Allen movie where, you know, all of a sudden someone off stage comes in who's representing the U.S. attorney with a view on this and helping us. You know that scene in one of the Woody Allen movies where someone's talking about Marshall McLuhan, and Marshall McLuhan then comes in, seeing Leslie, you know nothing of my work. What I gather from this conversation, sir, your testimony, is that we've got two issues before us. One is the city has the right to sit down and negotiate a change in the contract with our labor partner. So that's a separate issue. And that's guided by a set of rules and laws. The second issue, though, is if we eliminate the 48-hour rule, what is the best practice in order to get the information we need and not unduly compromise potential criminal investigations? Mr. Handelman earlier testified, I think he made it a compelling point, that given that there are very rarely criminal charges brought against police officers, if he had to err on the side of one, he'd rather have earlier investigations to be able to develop evidence which can be used in a disciplinary proceeding to bring charges against police officers who violate policies and rules, even at the cost of the occasional person. But that's really the tension. And I'm heartened that you're here, because it seems to me, Mayor, we have an opportunity with the Justice Department assistance to come up with a model rule. To Commissioner Fritz's point, there's other jurisdictions to do this. Come up with a standard that we could then consider adopting based on what you think is the best practice, and bring the district attorney into that conversation, because I think the best outcome is one that the police bureau, the DA, and the feds all think is best practice. And then we can discuss that with the community.
Yeah, and I don't want to, you know, I respect Mr. Handelman's view, and I don't think that would be the view of the U.S. Attorney's Office, that we would sacrifice a criminal prosecution to.
No, I understand, but I think he was making it also for dramatic effect. That since there isn't much of one and limited on the other, he was just stating a preference. But
our view is that you don't jeopardize a criminal prosecution by doing something which is required by the settlement agreement as it stands now, for the Portland Police Bureau to require a use of force report before the end of the shift, because that's a routine report that officers currently fill out for any use of force except deadly force. And so the settlement agreement that we have with the city of Portland requires that use of force report to also be required for deadly force.
What is your view about the impact of the settlement agreement on collective bargaining law?
That's higher than my pay scale. I'm not prepared to speak on that. I do believe it doesn't upset those rights. I know the Portland Police Association is at the table with the settlement agreement, and something I'm not prepared to address.
Thank you, sir.
That's a use of force report. It's not an interview. It's a standard. I'm filling out my report at the end of the shift. Does the settlement agreement specify when that should be done by?
Yeah, before the end of the shift.
No, I mean when we have to change the policy to require that.
You know, it's we're not going away until the settlement agreement is complied with. We'll either change the settlement agreement or the settlement agreement will be complied with.
So some of the paragraphs in settlement agreements say specify by such and such date. That one doesn't.
It doesn't have a timeline, and it does require us to consult with the district attorney, which we are consulting with, as well as the city of Portland, because we understand there are complex issues, and the last thing we want to do is jeopardize a criminal prosecution. But at the same time, we do feel that the law is on the side of at least allowing some limited routine reporting, and the analysis is pretty clear that you know, public employees have a job to do. This is, you know, the distinction with Oliver North and a police officer is that police officer, you know, part of the daily job duties is to fill out a use of force report when force is used, and so you're not bringing them before some, you know, special proceeding and compelling them at the threat of losing their job to answer questions. You're just requiring them to do their job, and if they don't do their job, you can discipline them. And we think the case law is pretty clear on that, although, as I said, we're still in discussions. There are some unique aspects of Oregon law, and we're discussing those with the district attorney and the city attorneys.
So the city attorney and the district attorney, and you are in those discussions.
Yes.
I'm really glad to hear that. Just to clarify, I don't know that it's a national standard that I would want to follow. I think that in many cases, our work with the Department of Justice here in conjunction with the settlement agreement, we are setting the best practices. And so it's not like I think we should be following, you know, name the jurisdiction where something horrendous has happened and there wasn't an outcome the community had confidence in. We should not be following their practices. I'd like to see but I would be interested to know what Beaverton, Medford, other jurisdictions in Oregon, because as you said, Oregon's laws are slightly different and we obviously have to be in compliance with them. Thank you very much.
I think the benefit for me of knowing what a national standard is, if one exists, is that it disproves the negative. To the extent that we're told you can't do something and there's a parade of horribles, if routinely it is done differently elsewhere, then that gives us confidence we're going the right direction.
Thank
you. We will obviously craft our own rule. But when do you think those negotiations will be through?
Hard to say.
What's holding them up?
We have meetings scheduled for next month, the beginning of next month, and we're hoping to, you know, this is something that is a priority of the U.S. attorney to get resolved, and so we're trying to escalate a resolution.
But is there something is there something we can do, the city can do, to accelerate them?
I'm not sure.
Thank you very much. Thank you all. Anyone else want to speak on this item? Any further questions for our bureau or our consultants?
I actually have a question for the auditor and Director Sevier.
Could you come up, please, auditor?
So yesterday evening, I attended a fundraiser for the National Crime Victims Law Institute, which is based out of Lewis and Clark. And it is a support service for the victims of crimes. And I learned that there is very little support for the victims of crimes. And in fact, there's in some cases more support for the defendant in it. Well, there is more support for a defendant in a criminal prosecution than there is for the victim, that the defendant gets a public defender and advice on every step of the way through the law system. The victim does not. And so I'm wondering, when somebody comes to IPR with a complaint, do we have any resources or any – do we refer them to any kind of support services to help either the bereaved family or the victim who survived and is now trying to pursue justice through your system? Is there anything that we do to support them?
So when somebody files a complaint with IPR, the only time where there is a, let's say somebody can help them shepherd through the process or advocate, is at the appeal stage, where our office provides them with a former CRC, Citizen Review Committee member, as a appeal process advisor, and then also we refer them to the National Lawyers Guild if they want to avail themselves of that.
So this was new information to me. I just assumed that there were people who would be helping, and similarly I had previously assumed that there would be counseling and other support services for police officers who are involved in extremely distressing situations. I know that we have an employee assistance program. However, there isn't necessarily a formal way that that officers are encouraged to use that or whether they do. And so I just wanted to put that out there as something that we should be thinking about, is how do we support people who are coming to you with a perceived injustice, with something horrible that happened to them? How are the places, like, could we give them information about the Crime Victims Law Institute or the other services at Multnomah County or elsewhere that we could encourage them to seek the kind of counseling, legal assistance beyond the National Lawyers Guild?
So we do refer community members who, you know, so let's say someone comes to our office and they present themselves with some sort of mental health issue in particular, that we have a relationship with different community groups that will say, hey, here's a number that you might want to call. But the difficulty with that kind of thing, there isn't one place that you can call, and particularly with people who are in a position of crisis, they want simplicity. And unfortunately, as you know, in other kind of realms, there isn't a very simple process for any of this, where that, you know, if somebody comes to our office, they are either in some sort of crisis or they're very upset, giving them four or five different phone numbers that may or may not be of some use to them. I don't know how much good we're doing. We do that sometimes, where it's just, you know, our office is set up under city code to help process community member complaints about police misconduct and also to get commendations. And so we don't want to be in a position of trying to diagnose or say, you know, you are, let's say, a victim of police misconduct, because that's, you know, our system, we're the fact gatherers and we're supposed to be a neutral body.
Right. I wasn't saying that I thought it was your job to do that, and I know you don't have staff to do that. Mayor, in your conversations with the county chair as through the budget, it seems to me this is a big gap in our system, that we don't provide services to victims and we don't help them work through a very traumatic experience that they've experienced, perhaps even to the same extent that we are required to provide public defenders and other structured support to those who may have committed a crime. I just wanted to raise that as an issue.
And it's my understanding in other jurisdictions where I've lived that there's a distinction between a crime victim, and that there are programs that I believe reside or are associated with the district attorney's office. And so there's the obvious central function there that a crime victim will most likely end up interacting with them, and they have some support systems. And I believe those are state-funded programs, and I do not know if Oregon has anything like that or not.
I just learned about this last night, so it's something that I could contact the district attorney and ask what we have here, in addition to talking to the county chair. It seems like a missing piece from our system that we're trying to improve.
And I would say that for the complainants at IPR, they aren't necessarily crime victims as well as complainants. And so I think that maybe more of attention has been given to the crime victim side than somebody who comes in with a complaint not being a victim.
Yeah, I was thinking specifically in the use of deadly force or the use of force that...
Okay. Oh, okay. There's, I'm sorry, yeah. I didn't understand that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking for a complaint about somebody using a swear word or something, okay, but more of the serious force issues. Thank you.
Madam Auditor,
thank you.
Can I follow up on a question that Dan raised, which is, what are your plans to continue the reporting, and do you have the budgetary resources to do so?
The contract with the OIR group ends at the end of this month, and it is our intention to open up the competition through the RFP process for the next round. And I believe in our current budget, we have the money to do that. And we are, when we put our proposal in, we're cutting some of the money we have set aside for the contract, but not the contract amount. So that is in our discussion.
So you are proceeding with a new RFP?
Yes, okay. That's our intention.
Doing a new RFP. And just to be clear, do you have sufficient resources to fund that, or might you be seeking an additional appropriation?
I believe we have the proper resources to fund the next RFP process.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Further questions or discussion? And if not, a motion to accept the
so report. Moved.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Fritz. I'm somewhat heartened that both chambers are not filled the way they have been on some of these previous reports. I do believe that we're making progress. I know that we all know that we need to make more and that we're by no means where all of us want to be, which is zero use of deadly force and appropriate staffing and training and support for our police bureau. But I think we're making, I know we're making progress, and I know that many of the folks who testified today have also been engaged in the Community Oversight Advisory Board for the Department of Justice Settlement. And again, I believe that they are making progress from what I've seen. So thank you, Chief O'Day, and your entire team. I am extremely encouraged by your acknowledgement of the recommendations and your willingness to work on them. As you said, I believe there is a changing culture in the police bureau, certainly not all the way, the same way that the rest of the city government and indeed the rest of society is not where we need to be when dealing on issues of race and people experiencing mental illness. It's heartening that we're making progress, though. Thank you. And thank you very much to our consultants and for a very good report and all of the guidance that you've given us over the years. I hope you'll be applying for the RFP process. It'll be a fair and open process, as you would expect. Thank you. Aye. Yes.
Agree with everything Commissioner Fritz just said. I want to thank the mayor. He has made this a priority in his administration. And as Commissioner Fritz noted, we've had hearings here on this topic that have been filled, the room filled. And I, too, am heartened by the response of the Bureau to the recommendations and the fact that of the 31, you have agreed largely without condition to the vast majority of them, and there are two that still remain in dispute. And I'm especially heartened to hear from our friends at the U.S. Attorney's Office that there is a collaborative process underway to resolve the issue of how, once the 48-hour rule is removed, and I say that advisedly, once the 48-hour rule is removed in the contract, how we're going to administer the new protocol. And I really appreciate the conversation today. I learned a lot. I think it was very thoughtful. And I concur with Commissioner Fritz. We are clearly moving in the right direction. So thank you all very much. Thanks to our consultants. Aye.
Hale.
Well, it is my privilege to work with Chief O'Day and this team of command staff and officers who have been changing the culture and practices of the Portland Police Bureau in very positive ways. And this is one more sign of that progress. So thank you, Commissioners. I think it is right to praise the good, and there's really good work underway here. And I think it's also really important that we have this kind of objective, nationally informed outside review of what we do, because deadly force is the most dire and terrible interaction any government can ever have with one of the people that it serves. And so we have to always take it seriously. Part of the burden of being police commissioner is that when there are officer-involved shootings, the chief calls the commissioner in charge and you go to the scene. And so, therefore, in these regrettable moments, I've had a chance to see some of these procedures in action, and also how assiduously, seriously the Bureau takes these cases. I mean, there is great care, great effort. No detail spared. Sometimes even at those scenes, I'm in a hurry for them to get on with it, and George Burke and his team are methodical about we're going to do it the right way every step of the way, and I appreciate that, and that's the way it should be. So I really appreciate this good work. Thank you to the OIR group for a clear and thoughtful review. Thank you, Chief O'Day, for thoughtful response as well. And I really appreciate where we are today and where we are not. Thank you for great work. The fact that this is a thoughtful discussion among concerned citizens.